Take your Bibles, if you will, and turn to the Gospel of Mark, chapter 8. The Gospel of Mark, chapter 8. I, if you know me at all, would recognize that I'm not a baker. I am not someone who has the gift of cooking, but especially of baking. Thankfully, I did marry someone who does have that particular skill, and it is certainly a blessing to me. One of the things that she doesn't do, however, is bake bread. We thankfully have a bakery around the corner that offers it quite cheaply and quite good bread, so that she doesn't have to take that time. Now, you may think, well, that's a silly thing to start with, but one of the things that we're going to be looking at is this idea of bread today. And I want you to know that I will be saying certain things about the making of bread, and I do that not from experience, but from book learning. However, I do study the scriptures, which is the bread of life, Jesus Christ revealed in them. And so I do hope that you will bear with me as I do some talking about physical bread, so that you will get the spiritual bread that we'll see this morning, this afternoon. So we're looking specifically at the first 21 verses of Mark chapter 8. And the reason that we read the end of chapter 7 and a little further in chapter 8 is because the 21 verses that we're looking at have those other sections bear upon these to a large degree in my mind. So, but we're going to read starting in verse 1. In those days, the multitude being very great and having nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples unto him, and saith unto them, I have compassion on the multitude, because they have now been with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. And if I send them away fasting to their own houses, they will faint by the way, for divers of them came from far. And his disciples answered him, From whence can a man satisfy these men with bread here in the wilderness? And he asked them, How many loaves have ye? And they said, 7. And he commanded the people to sit down on the ground, and he took the 7 loaves, and gave thanks, and brake, and gave to his disciples to set before them. And they did set before the people. And they had a few small fishes, and he blessed, and commanded to set them also before them. So they did eat, and were filled. And they took up of the broken meat that was left 7 baskets. And they that had eaten were about 4,000, and he sent them away. And straightway he entered into a ship with his disciples, and came into the parts of Dalmanutha. And the Pharisees came forth and began to question him, seeking of him a sign from heaven, tempting him. And he sighed deeply in his spirit and saith, Why doth this generation seek after a sign? Verily I say unto you, no sign, excuse me, there shall no sign be given unto this generation. And he left them, and entering into the ship again departed to the other side. Now the disciples had forgotten to take bread, neither had they in the ship with them more than 1 loaf. And he charged them, saying, Take heed, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, and of the leaven of Herod. And they reasoned among themselves, saying, It is because we have no bread. And when Jesus knew it, he saith unto them, Why reason ye because ye have no bread? Perceive ye not yet, neither understand? Have ye your heart yet hardened? Having eyes, see ye not, and having ears, hear ye not, and do ye not remember? When I break the 5 loaves among 5,000, how many baskets full of fragments took ye up? They say unto him, 12. And when the 7 among 4,000, how many baskets full of fragments took ye up? And they said, 7. And he said unto them, How is it that ye do not understand? So the first thing we're going to do is an overview of our narrative, the first portion of which is the feeding of the 4,000. In Christian circles, are probably more familiar with the feeding of the 5,000 than the feeding of the 4,000. In fact, some modern-day scholars think that they are the same events given twice, which I don't think we have to even spend any time debunking. But here is the feeding of the 4,000. Jesus is still in the Decapolis region, and I think that's very important for us to recognize because it is still a Gentile region. If you remember the story of the madman of Gadara, and I wish we knew his name so we wouldn't constantly call him a madman, because Jesus healed him. But if you remember the narrative of the madman of Gadara, this is the same region. And if you remember back, when he healed that madman, what did the people of that area ask him to do? They said, We want you to leave. We don't want you here. Just go away from us. And the madman wanted to go with Jesus, but Jesus told him, "No, I want you to go to your friends and to your family and tell them what God has done for you." And he departs. So Jesus is back in that area now. This is where he's been teaching for 3 days. And as time goes on, he has compassion on them. Now, we could wish that we had what he was preaching for 3 days. We don't have that record. We don't have what it is that he spoke to them. I would venture to say that it is similar to what he has said throughout the Gospels. That he's preaching the gospel of the kingdom. That he's telling them the same things that we learn in the Sermon on the Mount and other places. But we don't have that record. During Matthew's account of the same event, the parallel account, it says that he was not only teaching but also healing the people during those 3 days. That he healed every one of them. He healed the lame, the blind, the dumb, the maimed, and others. Cast out evil spirits. He was doing all of this during his teaching time over those 3 days. And the multitude wondered and glorified God at these healings. They were amazed. Now, at different times in the Gospel of Mark, we hear of astonishment at his teaching. But we don't hear that in this instance. We hear about amazement in Matthew about all of the healings that he performed. But nothing at his teaching. And so Jesus comes and he tells the disciples that he has compassion on the multitude. And it's one thing to think about that Jesus has compassion on those in common grace. Because most of these people are not going to become Christians that we're aware of. It's quite possible that they do, but to our knowledge, they don't. They don't follow him. And yet, he has compassion on them. And that's something that we as Christians, if you're a Christian today, you ought to think about. That God still has compassion on those, even those that are not touched by the saving grace of God. And that we ought to emulate the same thing. He's concerned for their well-being, their physical well-being, as well as their spiritual well-being. And here it seems that the disciples are a bit thick-headed. Yeah, they're not quite getting what Jesus is trying to do. And he certainly brings that out towards the end of this passage. But even at the beginning, they've already seen him do amazing things. Walking on water, calming the storm, feeding 5,000 with 5 loaves. And when Jesus says, "I have compassion on the multitude, we need to give them something to eat." Therefore, our first thought is, where can we get enough bread to feed this many? They could have just simply said, "Lord, what would you have us do?" But that's not their thought. Their thought is, how can we possibly do this? And so Jesus asked them how much they have, and they have 7 loaves. Of bread, and then it comes out that they have a few small fish as well. And so Jesus commands the people to sit down, and he gives thanks for the bread, and he distributes it. He gives it to the disciples, and then the disciples give it on to the multitude. He then gives thanks for the fish and repeats that process. And when they're finished and they've eaten their fill, they have taken up 7 baskets full. And it's an interesting side note that the baskets that's mentioned here is a different basket that is mentioned for the feeding of the 5,000. The basket that's mentioned for the feeding of the 5,000 is the word that's used for a common Jewish basket for household goods. The basket that's used here in chapter 8 is the same word that's used for the basket that Saul was let down off the wall of Damascus in. It's a much larger basket. But there are 7 of these baskets full of the fragments. We see that Jesus always meets and exceeds the need in the lives of his people. And so, when you think about this, when you consider what's taking place, it's surprising then that the Gospel of Mark moves on very quickly from this event. There is no talk about what it meant. There's no discussions around it. But suddenly in verse 10 it says, "And straightway he entered into the ship with his disciples." And they go to a different part of the Lake of Galilee, of the Sea of Galilee. And they get out of the ship. And as soon as they get out of the ship, a group of Pharisees meet them. And these Pharisees gather together. And they ask of him a sign. They say, "We want to see a sign." Now, the sign that they're asking for is not some miracle that he might perform, because he's actually been doing that all over the place, hasn't he? And if they had studied the scriptures, they would see that his healings of the blind and the deaf and the lame would actually point to the fact that he is the Messiah. But instead of that, they are seeking a different type of sign. They're seeking some type of sign in the heavens, some type of loud bang, if you will, that will notify everyone that now the Messiah is here to overthrow the Romans, to defeat the enemy. Their request is showing a desire, number one, for certainty, not faith. And it's also showing that they don't expect there to be an answer. They don't expect Jesus to actually give them a sign because they don't believe that he is who he says he is. And so they're trying to set him up for a failure. Now, in the Gospel of Mark, we're told that Jesus says no sign is going to be given them. In Matthew, he says no sign is going to be given to them except the sign of Jonah. And it's important to recognize exactly what Jesus is talking about. Because they're not looking for a sign like Jonah. They're looking for a sign in the heavens. Because the sign of Jonah was not in the heavens, was it? It was in the deep. But what was the sign of Jonah? What was it to the Israelites? It was a sign that God was going to bring redemption to their enemies. It was a sign that God was working peace in the souls of mankind that they didn't want peace worked in. It was a sign that Jonah was in the belly of the whale for 3 days and three nights, that the Son of God was going to be in the belly of the earth for 3 days and three nights, and he was going to rise again for the redemption of those that Israel didn't want redeemed. They were hoping for just the nation, but they were going to get more than that. And as soon as this exchange is over, as soon as Jesus says this to the Pharisees, he leaves. Now, we understand that Jesus is sovereign, that he knows all things. And so he comes to this part of the Sea of Galilee, gets out of the boat, has a confrontation with the Pharisees surrounding this information about a sign, and he tells them this, and then he gets right back in the boat again and goes to another place. So that his purpose was very specific, wasn't it? He went to this part of the Sea of Galilee for a reason, to have this confrontation with the Pharisees so that he might then teach his disciples something from it. And so they get back in the boat and they go on, and we see this lack of understanding on the part of the disciples. And so they get in the boat and he charges them that they should beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. And when they get in the boat, they forget to take bread with them. Now, this seems quite silly from our perspective, doesn't it? Because just either earlier in the day or the day before, Jesus had just fed 4,000 people with 7 loaves. And there were 7 huge baskets full left over. They didn't need to go buy bread. They could have just taken some bread from those baskets into the boat with them, and they would have had enough to eat. But instead, they got into the boat with 1 small loaf. Now, when I think of a loaf of bread, I think of something like this, where we could probably all have a sandwich from. But when they're talking about a loaf here, it's just a small bun. Certainly not enough for 13 men to eat from, unless you have Jesus with you. Because what can Jesus do? He can provide, can't he? He's shown it. And so they get in the boat and they have no bread. And Jesus begins to speak to them about the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod, but he's not speaking about actual leaven. He's not actually speaking about the ingredient in bread. He's actually speaking about the doctrine of the Pharisees and the doctrine of Herod. But because they had forgotten to bring bread, the only thing they can think of is he's talking to us about bread. And he's rebuking us because we didn't bring bread with us. Their thought is just on the here and now. And that's what they're focused upon. They're not even taking into account the miraculous feeding that had just taken place. And so Jesus rebukes the disciples. And Jesus is quite rough on them here. When you read this, it's almost like he's a quick fire questions that they don't even have time to respond to. in the rebuke that he's giving to them. In Mark 6:52, a few chapters before, after the feeding of the 5,000, when they're on the Sea of Galilee, and Jesus performs a miracle, we're told that the disciples were afraid after that miracle because they considered not the miracle of the loaves, for their heart was hardened. And here we have the similar situation. They considered not the same type of miracle. The feeding of the 5,000 they didn't learn any lessons from, and now here's the feeding of the 4,000 and they haven't learned any lessons from it. And you see this pattern developing with the disciples. And Jesus asks them, is your heart hardened? What's going on? How do you not understand? How do you have eyes to see who I am and you still don't see who I am? How do you have ears to hear all that I've been teaching and you still don't know who I am? That I could be in the boat with you and you could have one little loaf and that's enough. You don't need any more. You don't have to be focused on those things. Seek not these things, but seek ye first the kingdom of God. And they just don't get it. They just don't understand. He's been teaching them and they don't get it. Listen to the way he speaks to them in verse 17. And when Jesus knew it, he saith unto them, why reason ye because ye have no bread? Perceive ye not yet, neither understand? Have ye your heart get hardened? Having eyes, see ye not, and having ears, hear ye not? And do ye not remember? And then he proceeds to ask them about the very miracles that he's performed. And he says, when I fed 5,000, how many baskets full did you take up? I only used 5 loaves, and yet you took up 12 basketfuls. Now that I've fed 4,000 with 7 loaves, how many baskets full did you take up? 7 basketfuls. And they're the large baskets. How is it that you're still worried about bread? How is it that you're still concerned about this physical thing when I'm trying to teach you spiritual things? So we have some lessons that we can learn from this. The first lesson, and it may have skipped us by a little bit, but is when the Lord asks us to do something, even if we don't want to do it, we ought to do it. We ought to obey. Even if it doesn't seem in any way, shape, or form like it's the thing we want in our lives. So remember the madman of Gadara. Do you remember him? And we mentioned him a little bit ago, but he had to go back to the Decapolis. He had to go back to the 10 cities in that area, those Gentile cities, and he had to proclaim to those people that had wanted nothing to do with him before what God had done for him. And we remember that Jesus was asked to leave, and he left, just touching that one life. Now he's back in that area, and what's happened? The multitudes have come out. There are at least 4,000 people, most likely closer to 10,000, because they're probably only counting men at this point, but somewhere between 4,000 to 10,000 people who have sat and listened to Jesus teach and had him work miracles for 3 days. What's the difference? In that time span, the only difference is the madman of Gadara, who has gone around and told people what Jesus had done for him. So that when Jesus returns, everybody wants to hear. Everybody wants to see. Everybody wants to be touched by Jesus. When we know what we ought to do, we should do it, whether it feels good, whether it's something we want, or even something that looks better. Because it certainly, for the madman, would have been looking so much better to be with Jesus than to have to go back to the cities where nobody wanted him. And yet, what takes place? God is glorified to an incredible degree because of his obedience, so that he proclaims the name of Christ. One of the things we can learn is, how do we treat other people? The disciples seem very reticent to help in the feeding of the 4,000. It's possible because it's a Gentile area. It's possible because they're now in a Gentile area. This isn't a Jewish area, and they may not want anything to do with them. We don't know that for certain, but it certainly comes across that way because later on in the book of Acts, in Acts chapter 10, it takes a lot for Peter to get it through his head that he needs to go to the house of Cornelius, who is a Gentile, and that God has actually sent him to a Gentile. It's hard for him to reconcile that with everything that he knows. And so we see that it takes time, doesn't it, for that to really sink in. Think about this. After the feeding of the 5,000 in John chapter 6, Jesus spoke to the Jews regarding the fact that he was the bread of life. And he's speaking to the Jews, and those Jews that were there wanted to make him king, didn't they? Now Jesus is not just feeding Jews, he's feeding Gentiles in the same manner that he fed the Jews. I can't think that the disciples would have looked too kindly upon that. And then as soon as this is done, he goes to another part of the Sea of Galilee and tells the Pharisees, oh, by the way, the only sign I'm giving you is the sign of Jonah. And we always think about the sign of Jonah as the fact that he's going to die and be in the grave for 3 days. But that's not the only part of the sign of Jonah. It's that he's going to be sent to Nineveh, to the enemies of the Jews, for their salvation. And you see this feeding of the 4,000 in that context, and it kind of opens up a bit. And the disciples may not understand, but you get the feeling they do not want to understand. They don't want the gospel to be going to the Gentiles as it's going to the Jews. It's possible that the disciples missed the meaning of the miracle because they were so busy. And this is something we sometimes miss as well, because Jesus takes the loaves, he takes those 7 loaves and he breaks them and he distributes them to who? To the disciples. What do the disciples then have to do? They have to distribute it to the 4,000. Now, I don't know how many of you have ever worked in feeding a large group. The largest groups I've ever worked in feeding is somewhere between 100 to 150 people at one time. And it's hard work. And you're doing, all you're constantly thinking is, what do I have to give next? Well, here are the 12 disciples distributing bread and fish to 4,000 at least. And you can kind of get the sense that they may have missed some things because of the fact that they were so busy. And I think there's a lesson for us there as well, that we have to be careful that our busyness is not seen as spirituality. Just because we may be busy for the Lord doesn't mean that we are in a good spiritual condition before the Lord. Because if we're not spending time with Him in a personal situation, if we're not understanding the things that He's saying to us, as the disciples were not, they've missed the spiritual meaning of all of the wonderful blessings that they've been a part of. And I think we can do the same thing. Another lesson we can learn is certainly from the Pharisees. What do we look for when we seek direction? Because here the Pharisees are. They had the Old Testament scriptures. They had all the things that would declare who the Messiah is, where he was going to be from, what he was going to do. And yet, what are they asking for? Something that is not in the scriptures. They're asking for something outside of it. Very often, when we go to the scriptures, I think we find we're doing the same things the Pharisees did. That we're going in looking to prove what we already think. And we say, oh, you know what, I believe this, and so I'm going to go find scriptures that support what I believe. Instead of going to the scriptures and saying, you know what, I've got to believe this because it's there. Not because I like it, not because it's what I've already thought, but because this is clearly what scripture is teaching me. And let scripture guide us as opposed to our own desires, because the Pharisees certainly let their own desires guide them, not the scriptures guide them. We should not seek direction from the events of life either. God has amazing providence, and God can and does use every circumstance for His glory. And we can see people being saved in situations and you wonder, how in the world? They're so far off doctrinally. How can someone become a Christian in that? And yet God uses it. His word goes forth, and He's going to use His word as it goes forth, no matter who's speaking it, no matter for what purpose they're speaking it. Paul tells us this. And yet we sit back and we say, oh, I shouldn't be doing it that way. We ought not to look for God's providences as our direction in life. We have His revealed word. We ought to seek His revealed word for what we ought to do and thank Him for the providences. Thank Him for the way He works that we don't know how, that the secret things belong to Him. But most of all, a lack of spiritual understanding is deadly. The disciples receive a rebuke from Jesus here, unlike just about any other rebuke you're going to read in the New Testament. Why? Because they missed the spiritual meaning of what Jesus was doing. Because they completely missed it. And that's why he's so persistent. He's just hitting them with questions and saying, how can you not get it? After all I've said to you, after all you've seen, how are you still missing the fact that I'm the bread of life? That I'm not just sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, I'm sent to the Gentiles as well. That if I'm lifted up, I'm going to draw all to myself. That's what he's going to do. That's who he is. And they don't get it. They don't understand. And they had eyes, but they didn't see who he was. They had ears, but they didn't hear what he was saying. And that's a danger that we may sit in as well. They certainly seemed like they were too familiar with Jesus. They couldn't see the forest for the trees. Do we have the same situation? Thankfully, he has amazing patience, doesn't he? Because he doesn't just leave it there. He doesn't say, all right, I'm giving this up as a lost cause. I'm going to go start over with someone else. He continues to work with the disciples. He continues to teach the disciples. He continues to bring them on. But we certainly need to apply the lessons on bread. See, Jesus is the bread of life. He declares it himself. And throughout the scriptures, he's painting this picture of himself. And when you think of bread, what is it? It is the life-giving thing that we all need. Now, we can debate the benefit of modern bread and the gluten and anything else. But it's a staple of life throughout the world, bread is. In Mark 2, Jesus defends the disciples and himself by telling the Pharisees what David did in 1 Samuel 21. Remember the story. He's fleeing from King Saul. He is fleeing for his life and he stops by the tabernacle. And he speaks to the high priest and asks him for something to eat. And the high priest says, I've only got the showbread. And David says, okay, well give that to me. And the high priest says, well, you have to be sanctified. There are certain rules. And he says, well, my men and I are sanctified. We've those rules apply to us, so we can eat of the bread. Now, according to the Jews, he took 5 loaves. And he left 7. This is according to their own traditions, not Christianity imposing it upon them. So according to the Jews, David took 5 loaves from the 12 that would be there at the table of showbread. And we can certainly draw some parallels from that. How many loaves did Jesus feed the 5,000 with? He fed them with 5 loaves. That congregation was a predominantly Jewish congregation. How many basketfuls did they take up? Well, according to the Jewish basket, they took up 12 basketfuls. One for each tribe, if you will. Now they're in a Gentile area. How many loaves were left over from the table of showbread? There would have been 7 loaves left over from that table. How many loaves does Jesus feed the 4,000 Gentiles with? 7 loaves. How many baskets full, the large Gentile basket, how many do they take up? 7. What does 7 represent in the scriptures? It's the number of fulfillment, of perfection. You read the lists in the Old Testament. 6 things does God hate. 7th is an abomination. 6 things does God love. 7th is perfection. You can read it over and over again. What is Jesus saying to us with these 2 miracles? He's the bread of life. Not just for the Jew, but for the Gentile alike. He is for anybody. For a person of any ethnic group. There's no restriction. This is the second instance where he said, you don't understand. You've missed the meaning. And he warns them about the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. And it's their doctrines that he's warning them of. The formalism and the tradition of the Pharisees and the skepticism of Herod. But leaven's not the same thing as yeast, is it? Now again, this is where my knowledge of baking breaks down a bit. But leaven and yeast are not the same thing. Leaven is much stronger and much more invasive than yeast is. A little leaven leaveneth the whole lump. It happens much quicker. And if you don't use the right amount of leaven, it will destroy the bread. It will destroy what you're trying to eat. And I think Jesus is telling them, you have to be careful. Just a little bit is too much when it comes to these doctrines that the Pharisees are teaching, that Herod is teaching. And he tells them that, you know, the tradition is, and I got this quote, and I don't remember who I got it from, but he said, tradition is the living faith of the dead. Traditionalism is the dead faith of the living. And that's exactly a picture of the Pharisees. If we're following a tradition just because it's a tradition, then it has no meaning. We have to have things that are biblically based. And the Pharisees completely missed that. And he's telling the disciples, you have to be biblically based. You have to be looking into the scriptures. And he tells them, don't be skeptical. You think about Psalm 1, blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor standeth in the way of sinners, nor sitteth in the seat of the scornful. Don't be like Herod. Don't be like those mockers. Follow after God. You think about it, in the history, in the centuries since the death and resurrection of Christ, what has done more harm to the cause of Christ? Has it been outward persecution? Or has it been inward heresy and sin? Over and over again, it would have to be inward heresy and sin. It would have to be those that claim to be Christians falling down on their faces because of sin or bringing in some false teaching. Persecution purifies it. Paul tells us a little leaven leaveneth the whole lump. Now, when you're thinking about this passage, I want you to see it from a bit of a higher overview. Because, as we would say, Peter is the one that's dictating to Mark these details of the Gospel of Mark. And we know Peter is a very action-oriented individual. And so there are certainly people that learn visually, and there are certainly people that learn from the ears. We can think that John, the Apostle John, he learned from the ear. We have so many records of the things that Jesus says from John. We have almost none, comparatively speaking, from Mark. Because Peter learns by the actions. But see, Peter, he saw the actions of Jesus in light of the Old Testament. And he applies these things and tells us, there is a picture being painted here by what Jesus is doing and what Jesus is saying of who he is. And in the construction of this portion of Scripture, there are some interesting things that take place. The reason that I read the last bit of Mark 7 is because there's a miracle there that's not repeated anywhere else in Scripture. So the healing of the blind man in Mark chapter 7 is not in any other gospel. There's a healing in Mark chapter 8, the deaf man in Mark chapter 7, the blind man in Mark chapter 8. The blind man in Mark chapter 8 is not anywhere else in any other gospel either. So you have this portion that we're looking at, these 21 verses we're looking at, and they're bookended by two miracles that no other gospel writer says anything about. Now, I don't think, as modern scholars would, that means that they didn't happen. I think they did happen, but there's so many things that Christ did that there's no author that could contain them all. But Mark brings them out for a reason. If you notice, in Mark chapter 7, Jesus performs a miracle differently than he normally does. If you really put your thinking hats on at the moment, think back to the Syrophoenician woman. When she's begging Jesus to heal her daughter, and they have the conversation about the dogs. And Jesus doesn't even say anything for the healing to take place. He just says, it's done. He does no actions. He performs no ritual. He says no words to heal the girl. He just tells the mother, it's been done. It's taken care of. And the girl is healed. Now in Mark chapter 7, what does he do? It says, and they bring unto him one that was deaf and had an impediment in his speech, and they beseech him to put his hand upon him. And he took him aside from the multitude and put his fingers into his ears, and he spit and touched his tongue. And looking up to heaven, he sighed and saith unto him, Ephphatha, that is, be opened. Now, did Jesus need to do that to heal the man? Of course not. Jesus is the all-powerful Son of God. He could have done the same thing that he did with the Syrophoenician woman or with the centurion. He could have just thought it and this man would have been healed. But instead he takes him aside from everyone else and he does this multi-part miracle. And he heals the man. He touches his fingers in his ears. He spits and touches his tongue. And then he speaks to heaven that this man's ears and tongue would be loosed. In chapter 8, we have the healing of the blind man. In verse 22, "And he cometh to Bethsaida, and they bring a blind man unto him, and besought him to touch him. And he took the blind man by the hand and led him out of the town. And when he had spit on his eyes and put his hands upon him, he asked him if he saw aught. And he looked up and said, I see men as trees walking. After that he put his hands again upon his eyes and made him look up. And he was restored and saw every man clearly." Now, was that a lack of power on Jesus' part? Of course not. That would be the farthest thing from our minds to say that that's possible. So he was doing it for a purpose, for a reason, to teach us something, to teach his disciples something. And what I would put to you is, sandwiched between these two miracles, where he takes these men aside that he's going to heal so that no one else sees them, and he heals them in this multi-part way, and then when he's done healing them, he says, don't tell anybody that I've done this. In the middle of that, we have this narrative about the bread. We have this narrative about the feeding of the 4,000. And beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the sign of Jonah to tell us that Jesus is coming not just to the Jew, but to the Gentile as well. And when the disciples are worried, they're worried about the physical instead of the spiritual. And Jesus says to them in verse 18, "Having eyes, see ye not? And having ears, hear ye not? And do ye not remember?" What had they missed? What was the lesson that they had missed in the feeding of the 4,000? It was the same lesson that they had missed in the feeding of the 5,000. It was the same thing that they missed when they were on the boat, and he's telling them to beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and of the leaven of Herod. It's the fact that he's the bread of life. It's the fact that he is the Messiah. He is the one to come. They've missed it. These two miracles bookend it for us, because here he's healing this blind man. At the end, here before it, he's healing this deaf man. And it's this multi-part miracle. And what happens just after this? He asks them, "Who do men say that I am?" And Peter says, "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God." And he tells them, don't tell anybody. Don't say it to anybody. Why not? Because they don't understand. They don't understand the very next thing he tells them, that he came to suffer, be rejected, and die. They miss that part because they're just thinking of the ruler, the one who's going to sit on the throne and reign, who's going to overthrow the Romans and set up the Jewish kingdom. And they miss the spiritual. They miss the fact that the Messiah has come to forgive sin, to work in the hearts of his people, that he is the true bread of life, that everyone has to take part of him spiritually by faith for salvation. And they've missed it. And in the book of Mark, as soon as he asks them that question, and Peter says that, he begins to teach them from that point forward that he came to die. And the first reaction is, no, that can't be. Peter rebukes him. And it's this idea that they need to understand all of who Jesus is. Not that he's just the Christ in their sense, but he is the Christ in the biblical sense. From the beginning to the end, that he is the Messiah who came to die for sinners. He is the Messiah who came to pay the price that we can't pay. And these miracles are pointing to the middle. They're pointing to the middle where Jesus says that you have eyes but you're not seeing. You have ears but you're not hearing. How long is it going to take for you to understand what I'm saying to you? And they're the words of life. You must come to him by faith. Don't think about the bread in the physical sense. That's only a picture to point you to me, to Jesus. That's what its aim is, so that you understand that I'm the Christ. And then once you understand that I'm the Christ, know what the Christ came to do. That he came to suffer. That he came to die. That he came to rise again, to show that he had victory over your sin and over your death. So that you can be with him where he is. That's what he's telling the disciples. That's the lesson they needed to learn. That's the same lesson we need to learn. It's the same thing that we need to understand, that he has all power, that it is all there. Think about who Jesus is. Think about all that he's done. It all points, all of the Gospel of Mark up to this point is pointing to the fact that Jesus is the Messiah. He is the Christ. But he's not just the Christ for the Jews. He's also the Christ for the Gentiles. Why? Because the Christ came to die. He came to die for sinners. Do you know him? Have you been forgiven by his blood? We point you to Jesus. Amen.